Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the uncontrolled outbursts that spewed from President Trump at a rally in Mississippi last night as he belittled Dr. Blasey Ford, who testified against Judge Kavanaugh. Despite having been repeatedly cautioned by his handlers not to inflame a delicate political situation as Kavanaugh's fate hangs by a thread, Trump clearly could not restrain himself, and his vitriolic mockery of Dr. Ford offended the very senators who are the swing votes Trump needs to seat Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court. Joseph Cerincione, the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons, joins us to discuss the danger of having a president who cannot control himself but has access to the nuclear button. Although we have been lucky, the country has not faced a crisis so far. The fact remains that Trump has the power at his fingertips to destroy the world. We'll assess the difference between a Trump administration full of unqualified amateurs, like Ambassador to NATO Kay Bailey Hutchinson, who just threatened to, quote, take out Russian nuclear missiles on their territory, and how President Kennedy handled the Cuban Missile Crisis by overruling his hawks, who recommended a nuclear strike, which would have led to a nuclear war. In contrast, if a real crisis struck, an erratic and uncontrollable Trump would be goaded on by his hawks, John Bolton and Mike Pompeo. Then we will speak with an historian of American political discourse and presidential rhetoric, Jennifer Machia, a professor in the Department of Communications at Texas A&M University, about the response to Trump's mockery of Dr. Blasey Ford from the three key senators whose votes he needs to confirm Kavanaugh, Senators Flake, Collins, and Murkowski. We'll discuss whether there is still an expectation among the American people that their head of state exhibit decorum and dignity, or are we back to the days of Andrew Jackson, with the difference being that Trump does not settle scores with dueling pistols, but rather uses Twitter to insult and demean his enemies, real and imagined. Then finally, we'll explore both the constitutional authority of the President of the United States and the constitutional restraints imposed on his authority, and speak with Corey Brettschneider, a professor of political science at Brown University and author of the new book, The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. He joins us to discuss whether, while California develops its own foreign and immigration policy and signs international climate treaties, a president under investigation can pardon himself, fire anyone in the executive branch, or wage war without congressional approval. And joining us now is Joseph Cerincione, the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He previously directed nonproliferation and international policy programs at the Center for American Progress and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and has also worked on the professional staffs of the House Committee on Armed Services and the Committee on Government Operations, and served as staff director of the Bipartisan Military Reform Caucus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joseph Cerincione.
Thank you for having me back on, Ian.
Well, thank you, Joe. And you're an expert on nuclear weapons and nuclear systems. And we and the Russians, of course, have thousands of nuclear weapons. But at the end of the day, it comes down on our side to the football, the briefcase that military aid carries at all times beside the president. On the Russian side, they have the cheget, which is the mirror of our football. So when you see a president, as we saw last night at a rally in Mississippi, railing against Dr. Blasey Ford, and we all know that his aides have been restraining him for weeks, and there's been a lot of coverage about how well he's behaving, and that he's not attacking her and not doing what he normally does. And, of course, there's a lot at stake for him with getting Brett Kavanaugh on the court. But he obviously cannot control himself. And then he just had this outburst, and now, of course, some of the key swing votes in the Senate, like Jeff Flake and Susan Collins, are first to decry what Trump has done. So, to my mind, what this says is that we have a president who cannot control himself. How do you see it?
I get very worried about national security threats every time I see the president take the podium at one of these rallies, and I see the way he winds himself up and the emotion that he sort of spirals up within him into this anger and this rage and this self-certainty. And then, you know, it's reinforced by the crowd, which is just cheering him on. I mean, this is a spectacle unlike anything we've seen in America before, at least in a president. We've never seen a president act like this. And he has an unparalleled amount of control over the most destructive military machine the world has ever created. So you're worried about two things, basically. One is whether he will do something that will start a war, that it will start a new war with Iran, for example. And the other is whether he will do something that would start a nuclear war, because the President of the United States has sole unfettered authority to the world's nuclear arsenal. And let me give you an example, just so this isn't just hypothetical. Late July, the president, in the middle of the night, it was around midnight, he tweeted out a threat to Iran in all caps. He threatened Iran with, quote, consequences the likes of which few throughout history have ever suffered, close quotes. Well, the problem is, of course, the President of the United States has the ability to, at a moment's notice, inflict consequences the likes of which few throughout history have ever suffered. He controls the nuclear arsenal. At all times, a military officer follows the president around. He's required to be within a minute of the president. So when the president is tweeting in the Lincoln bedroom, this officer is sitting outside the door, and the president can summon him at any moment. He carries a briefcase with the nuclear codes and communication equipment in it. The president can order him to open up that briefcase to connect him to the military command authority, and the president, once he identifies himself, can deliver an order to launch a nuclear weapon at Iran. Now, this is a system that was set up to protect the country, but we've never had a president like this, this volatile, this unstable. So, yes, the president's behavior at these rallies as he rails against his political opponents, real and imagined, gives me great fear about whether he's going to plunge America into a new war.
Well, but I think it's worse in the sense, Joe Cerincione, that we know that his aides have been trying to restrain him. They've obviously had lots of conversations with him. Do not trash this woman. And he's been fairly sober about it. He said nice things about her. So to my mind, this really shows that he simply couldn't stop it, what he was told not to do.
Yes. That he breaks through the restraint. He can't help himself. That's
right.
Exactly right. And so what happens when he's in a situation where his aides are actually egging him on? So in the case of Iran, and you've seen speeches and threats and rhetoric in Iran escalating daily, and that's because he now has aides, National Security Advisor John Bolton, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, that want to provoke him, that are as rabid as he is about Iran. That's what makes this situation so dangerous.
And again, I'm speaking with Joseph Cerincione, who's the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He previously directed nonproliferation and international policy programs at the Center for American Progress and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's also worked on the professional staff to the House Committee on Armed Services and the Committee on Government Operations, and served as staff director of the Bipartisan Military Reform Caucus. So in terms of what you were saying about the football, the nuclear codes with the military aid within a minute of the president at all time. So as he tweets out at, you know, 3 or 4 in the morning, there's this man sitting outside the door with his suitcase. So there is no impediment, is there, between the president and the suitcase, the football? In other words, the codes are in there. I know how it was set up during the Cold War for an incoming attack. Immediately, NORAD would pick it up in Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado. Then they would immediately alert the National Command Authority, the Pentagon. The Secretary of Defense would be alerted and immediately alert the president. How does it operate in the opposite direction? In other words, if it's not an incoming strike, but still he has the authority to launch nuclear weapons, offensively or preemptively, so what's to stop him?
Nothing. which is the scary part. And people don't believe me when I tell them this, because they're all used to seeing the scenario play out the way you describe, that there's an incoming attack, and then, of course, that the military picks that up first, and then the phone calls start. And by the time they get the president on the line, there's already a group of national security officials who are on the line with him, and they're allowed to have a brief conference, and that's the way the system is supposed to work. But it doesn't have to be the military calling the president. The president can call the military. And in that case, there's no set procedure, no requirement for the president to loop in his national security advisor or secretary of defense or secretary of state or even the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. The way the system works is that he gets connected immediately to the national command center, where the only thing that is required is that the officer in charge, and usually it'd be a three-star general, would then query the president with a challenge code, and the president would pull out the card that he's required to carry with him at all times, called the biscuit, where he then has a code to answer back, say Alpha Delta Bravo 7. And then once he's identified as the president, well, then he can give the command. And so the book that he carries around, the book that's in the nuclear football, is like a Chinese menu of nuclear options, you know, from one up to 1,000, with different target sets that he can choose, and these all have codes. And now, so he would then give that order. He would order a particular attack. This actually was all illustrated brilliantly in a recent episode of Madam Secretary on CBS. It was their season finale, just rebroadcast a couple of weeks ago, which shows the actual process that goes through. In this case, it was a false attack that was called off at the last minute, but it shows the process. At that point, the commander of the Military Operations Center would then contact the Strategic Command, where they actually implement the order. And so then another general will be brought on board. But that's it. That's all that's required. And as long as the order was legal, and by the fact that these operations are actually in the book, they're sort of pre-vetted to be legal. And you can imagine, for example, in a time of crisis with Iran, or for that matter, North Korea, if tensions are building and suddenly the general gets an order that the president is ordering a nuclear attack, they would implement that order. They are trained to implement the order. The whole process is built for speed and implementation, not for discussion and debate. So it would require a full-scale mutiny by the military in order to stop a nuclear command given by the president, even one as unstable as Donald Trump.
So I think the point is, though, surely, Joseph Cerenzioni, that we've been lucky so far that we haven't had a real crisis. And we know that many presidents have been tested by a real crisis, going back to JFK with the Cuba crisis. And the hawks, like the head of Strategic Air Command, Curtis LeMay, were badgering JFK to launch nuclear weapons against Cuba. And that would have, and we now know in retrospect that the Russians on the ground in Cuba had the authority to retaliate with the nuclear weapons that they had there. So,
yes.
And then, of course, that would have led to a wider exchange of nuclear weapons. And Curtis LeMay got so mad at Kennedy that he was telling everybody the guy's a wimp and a wuss and all this stuff.
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly what happened. Yeah. We knew that there were missiles on Cuba. We did not know and didn't find out for years later that there were also 150 nuclear warheads deployed in and around Cuba that could be mated up with those missiles, and that the commanders on Cuba had the authority to fire them. So you're absolutely right. Curtis LeMay and the Joint Chiefs were recommending attack, and there were three men that stopped it from happening: Robert Kennedy, the president himself, John Kennedy, and Robert McNamara. Now, where in this cabinet can you find people like that now? I would say you can't, with the exception of Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis. I don't think any of the other people around the president would be able to restrain him or talk him out of an order to fire.
Well, you just mentioned a little while ago that you were afraid that they may, in fact, do the opposite and goad him.
Yes. And in the case of Iran, I think they would goad him into an attack. And that's what you see. I mean, there's actually a march towards war with Iran building as we talk. Just today, John Bolton was in the took the podium of the White House to break a treaty that we have with Iran that goes back to 1955. It's a diplomatic treaty for consular relations. And he pulled the United States out of it and denounced Iran in the harshest possible talk, which similar to what the president himself did at the podium of the UN last week and speeches that Bolton and Pompeo gave in New York last week. So there is a drumbeat of anti-Iran rhetoric and threats and action that's steadily building up that has a lot of us worried. In fact, you're having members of Congress introduce legislation just last week. Senator Tom Udall introduced a bill to stop a war with Iran, demanding that any action with Iran be approved by Congress first, so that this fear that I'm talking about is not something that just I'm seeing. Lots of people are seeing this, are worried about it, and the more and more volatile and unpredictable and angry and vindictive the president gets, the more worried we are that this will not just be campaign rhetoric, but he might send missiles flying.
Well, there was some rhetoric coming from the U.S. ambassador to NATO, Kay Bailey Hutchinson, which has alarmed the Russians, and I don't know the extent to which it's alarmed the NATO allies, but she set off alarm bells on Tuesday when she suggested the United States might, quote, take out Russian missiles that the U.S. says are violating the INF arms control treaty.
Yes. It alarmed me. My emails exploded over this, and it got even worse when we all read the transcript of what she said. She may not have meant to, but what she did was threaten a preemptive military attack against Russian missiles, nuclear-capable cruise missiles that the Russians are deploying in Russian territory, and she said we would take them out. Now, about 10 hours later, she walked it back and said, no, what she meant was we'd have to deploy countermeasures, we'd have to deploy missiles in kind, which is his own kind of provocation. But it shows what happens when you put in place incompetent, inexperienced people into key military situations. Kay Bailey Hutchinson knows jack about NATO. You know, it's like putting Betsy DeVos in. As education secretary. I mean, these people just don't know the field that they're now being put in charge of, and you can see the kinds of diplomatic consequences that result.
Well, I'm concerned in the broadest sense, since, as you know, and you worked on arms control throughout the Cold War, Joseph Rincione, and one of the differences now was when we were dealing with the Soviet Union, you were dealing with discipline and ideology that the state had, even though there were some very scary moments. And there was in October of 1993, but for the fact that a Russian missile officer decided to override an automatic counterstrike against the United States based upon a signal that there were five, I think, Minuteman missiles coming in, and he took it upon himself, thought, well, if the Americans are going to strike us in a first strike, they're going to send more than five. So he overrode the automatic thing, and he got demoted. So that's an example of their system or the flaws in their system. But overall, there was a control based upon a kind of ideology and a discipline. I don't believe that there's any ideology left in Russia today. Under Putin, it's just a straightforward thuggery and kleptocracy. So don't we have a fundamental problem here, which we've never had in geopolitics before, which is the combination of national security and organized crime, the mafia and nuclear weapons?
I think you really put your finger on it, Ian. You know, these systems were built up with certain assumptions and that there'd be certain norms followed. And what we've seen in both countries, in the United States and in Russia, is a collapse of those norms and a collapse of the types of governments that would control the most powerful weapons ever invented. And so you now have this kleptocracy, as you put it, this gang of oligarchs in Russia controlling nuclear weapons without some sort of ideology guiding them or even a coherent national security strategy guiding them. And here in the United States, can you identify an ideology that Donald Trump has? Is there coherent set of strategic thinking that he has. I mean, nobody talks about a Trump doctrine or, you know, the incoherence and I would say even insanity of the current leaders of these two countries really exposes the insanity and incoherence of the system they've inherited. It is nuts that each country has 2,000 hydrogen bombs ready to launch on a minute's notice. Why? For what? What military purpose does that serve? Even if you think we need nuclear weapons for deterrence, even if you think we need some to stop somebody else from attacking us, do you need 2,000 of them? Do they have to be launched immediately? Is it really true that one person can do this in both, by the way, Russia and the United States? It's nuts. You could go to much lower levels with much longer warning system, with a much greater requirement for a consensus. Even if you believe these weapons are necessary, you could tremendously reduce the risk with just making some changes in the structure and doctrine. And we're starting to see some, at least in the United States, look at this. Take a harder look at this. Let me give you one example. Adam Smith, the representative from Washington State, has introduced a bill calling for the policy of the United States to be changed to one of no first use. That is, under no circumstances would the United States launch a nuclear weapon first. So prevent the whole scenario we were just talking about Donald Trump getting angry in the middle of the night and starting a nuclear war. Adam Smith would become chairman of the House Armed Services Committee if the Democrats take back the House. So this is a man that might, in a month or so, be in a position to actually do something about this. This isn't some think tank proposal. This is what he believes. So, and part of the reason you're seeing people relook at these issues is because of the concern of the mental stability of the President of the United States.
Well, Joseph Cirincione, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Joseph Cirincione, who's the president of the Plowshares Fund and the author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons. He previously directed Nonproliferation International Policy Programs at the Center for American Progress and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He also worked on the professional staff to the House Committee on Armed Services and the Committee on Government Operations and served as staff director of the Bipartisan Military Reform Caucus. We're going to take a brief station break and back speaking with an historian of American political discourse and presidential rhetoric about whether there is still an expectation among the American people that their head of state exhibit decorum and dignity.